A Radical Look at Scottish History, Part 14, A Power in the West. In an earlier programme, I talked about the thalassocracy, or sea-based society, that had developed into what we now think of as Dalriada, and that this was effectively a society sitting between the different confederations of tribes that made up the early kingdoms of Scotland and Ireland. This area was, of course, not only subjected to extensive raiding by the Vikings, but like much of Ireland, was where what is known as Gall Gael culture developed. This came about from the combination of the indigenous Gaelic-speaking peoples and the Norse-speaking settlers from Scandinavia, who arrived after the raiders. In his book, Norse Influence on the Celtic, written in 1910, George Henderson drew attention to what this meant for the development of the Gaelic language. But in terms of Scottish history in general, the combination of the warrior traditions of the Dalriadan clans and the incoming Norse settlers gave rise to a society, the term kingdom does not seem a good fit, which was of considerable significance. In the far north, in what the Norse called the Nordreyar, Orkney and Shetland, there is no evidence of any Celtic place names, and the localised Germanic tongue called Norn survived into the 19th century. From the 9th to the 13th centuries, the majority of the Hebrides, Kintyre and the Isle of Man, the Sudreyar, or Southern Isles of the Norsemen, were collectively known as the Kingdom of the Isles, which can be seen as a Norse-influenced development of what had earlier been large parts of Dalriada. At some level, this was a society that looked north to Scandinavia, but it was made up of clans or kin groups, like most of mainland Scotland of the period. As in those clans, it is likely that loyalty among the warriors was first and foremost to their own kin. So how influential the role of the Norse kings, who later claimed so much of the area, was, must remain moot. The idea that such a society could have functioned along the lines of a modern nation-state is just simply untenable. That this is part of the world was normally under the overlordship of the Norse king till the Battle of Largs in 1263, quite possibly meant little to most of the population. Now, as early as the middle of the 12th century, a powerful leader came to the fore in the Kingdom of the Isles, and he has been seen by many historians as being of primary importance. This was Somerled, an early form of the modern Gaelic name Sorley. He is claimed as the founder of the Clan MacDonald, by the far the largest of our indigenous kin groups, and of the once more widespread Clan MacDougall, and his descendants were to prove significant in Scotland's history in the medieval period. While he was undoubtedly of Gall Gael origin, he has been seen by many as being more Scottish than Norse, a distinction he himself possibly may not have recognised. It is said that he was eventually killed in a battle against the Scottish army, the Battle of Renfrew in 1164. What chronicles we do have tell us that he had landed in Ayrshire with a large army, and it seems more than likely that he was responding to Scottish attempts to consolidate power over the Kingdom of the Isles, attempts that were possibly being led by the Stuarts from Ayrshire. We are also told that the Scottish army, not led by the current monarch Malcolm IV, was much smaller than Somerled's, but that after his death his forces retreated. This would fit in with what is known of clan and tribal warfare in general. Clans, like tribes everywhere, are rarely set on territorial or political conquest, except when part of a much larger and more structured army, and the focus of clan warfare is always much more akin to raiding than anything else. If the chief falls in battle, a new chief has to be appointed, and this generally would lead to his kin retiring from the battle to appoint a new leader. This is possibly what happened. Somerled's attack also underlines the ongoing reality that the leaders in the West, and in many other parts of the country, did not see themselves as being Scottish, even if Somerled had himself at one point fought alongside David against the English. The loyalty of any clan was essentially to its own people, and if it benefited them to work with kings or other leaders, then so be it. For a long time, Somerled's descendants likewise did not see themselves as subjects of any of the kings of Scots, at least not until they were forced to. Now, his descendants became known as the Lords of the Isles, though an earlier term was the Gaelic Ri in Shigail, which is generally translated as a king of the isles. Given the clan structure of Hebridean society, which all available knowledge suggests as having derived from earlier tribal structures, the translation of the Gaelic rí as kings seems problematical. The Welsh rí is translated as lord, which makes no sense at all within societies held together by ties of kinship. Perhaps it had a meaning more like chief, or even high chief, and may even have existed amongst the Picts, whose language is generally believed to have derived from the same or very similar roots as Welsh. Some linguists have postulated that Gaelic and the Brythonic, spoken by people living alongside each other throughout the first millennium in Scotland, may have had more in common than is generally considered in the modern world, where the differences between the Q Celtic of Gaelic and Irish and the P Celtic of Welsh and Breton have grown. Given the Christian and specifically Bible education of all of our early historians, the presentation of all leaders as kings is understandable, but not necessarily accurate. As we've noted, two major Scottish clans, the MacDonalds and the MacDougalls, claim descent from the sons of Somerled. But like so much of our history, what happened in the years after his death is unclear. What is clear is that the MacDonalds became a great power, and by the first half of the 14th century, John MacDonald of Isla was claiming the title of Lord of the Isles. Based at Finlaggan on Isla, he certainly appears to have had control over much of the Hebrides in the west coast. Again, though, it must be noted that this power appears to be essentially tribal. Now, this was shown possibly in his dealings with the English King Edward III. Although this never went beyond written communications, it does suggest that John was looking after his own or his own clan's interests, and that such interests superseded any idea of loyalty to Robert, King of Scots. Now, long before the British Army's ethnic cleansing and the final destruction of the Gaeltacht after Culloden, Scottish kings had seen the tribal societies of the Highlands and Islands as a constant threat, and the lords of the Isles in particular. Now, historians have a habit of looking, if not kindly, then certainly supportively on historical consolidations of power. Such events are presented as civilising, introducing the rule of law with a general subtext of bringing benighted savages into line. By concentrating solely on the actions of named individuals, that is, big men, they can ignore the realities of what such supposed advancement meant to the communities of the time. It may be stretching things a wee bit, but a comparison can be made with the centuries of invasion Scotland has been subjected to, and the repeated attacks by first Scottish, then English kings and governments on those areas of Scotland that marched to the sound of a different drum. That there was a clash of cultures between centralising monarchs, often of a brutal disposition, and a tribal society where inter-clan raiding meant there was a permanently available, highly effective and terrifyingly mobile corpus of trained warriors is undeniable. Part of Scotland's historical problem is that the presentation of this clash of cultures has always been one-sided. And it is all too easy, after the fact, to say that the outcome was inevitable, particularly when opposing sides are presented as modern or forward-looking on one side and archaic and primitive on the other. It was precisely the effectiveness of the clan warriors that saw them being used as the primary focus of the Jacobite uprisings of 17 and 1745, though it has to be remembered that both the exiled James VIII and his son Charles Edward Stuart saw the Highlanders and their lowland compatriots as no more than pawns in their struggle for the main prize, which for them was always England. Now, as Lord of the Isles, John, whose father Angus Og, had fought alongside Robert I at Bannockburn, was a consummate politician, and by his death in 1386, some historians have suggested he was king in all but name. But as we have seen, that is more than a little simplistic. Next time, we'll look at some different aspects of the Stuart kings of the Scots.